Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Janaranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Janaranjana. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3. Text 10. This is chapter 23, entitled Devahuti's Lamentation. Devahutir uvacha. Radham bada dvija varshita. I'm sorry. Radham bada dvija vrishata ramoga yoga. Maya dipe tvai vibho taravaimi bharta. Yastye pyadayis samaya sakridanga sango. Buyat kariya siguna prasava satinam. Radham batat vijavrishatad amoga yoga. Maya dipe tvai vibho tadavaimi bharta. Yaste byadai samaya sakrit anga sango. Bhuyat kariya siguna prasava satinam. Radam batat vijavrishai taramoga yoga. Maya dipe tvai vibho tadavaimi vartha. Yaste pyadayi samaya sakrit anga sango. Bhuyat kariya siguna prasava satinam. Devahuti Uvacha. Devahuti said, Radam, it has been achieved. Bata, indeed, Dvijavrisha, O best of the Brahmanas, Etat, this, Amoga, infallible. Yoga Maya of mystic powers. Adipe, the master. Tvayi, in you. Vibho, O great one. Tat, that. Avaimi, I know. Bartaha, O husband. Yaha, that which. Te, by you, abhyadayi, was given. Samayaha, promise. Sakrit, once. Angasangaha, bodily union. Bhuyat, maybe. Gariyasi, when very glorious. Gunaha, a great quality. Prasavaha, progeny. Satinam, of chaste women. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Sri Devahuti said, "My dear husband, O best of brahmanas, I know that you have achieved perfection and are the master of all infallible mystic powers because you are under the protection of Yoga Maya, the transcendental nature. But you once made a promise that our bodily union should now fulfill, since children are a great quality for a chaste woman who has a glorious husband." Purports. Devahuti expressed her happiness by uttering the word Bhatta, for she knew that her husband was in a highly elevated, transcendental position and was under the shelter of Yoga Maya. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, those who are great souls, Mahatmas, are not under the control of the material energy. The Supreme Lord has two energies, material and spiritual. The living entities are marginal energy. As marginal energy, a person may be under the control of the material energy or the spiritual energy, Yoga Maya. Kardama Muni was a great soul, and therefore he was under the spiritual energy, which means that he was directly connected with the Supreme Lord. The symptom of this is Krishna consciousness, constant engagement in devotional service. This was known to Devahuti, yet she was anxious to have a son by bodily union with the sage. She reminded her husband of his promise to her parents, "I will remain only until the time of Devahuti's pregnancy." She reminded him that for a chaste woman to have a child by a great personality is most glorious. She wanted to be pregnant, and she prayed for that. The word stri means expansion. By bodily union of the husband and wife, their qualities are expanded. Children born of good parents are expansions of the parents' personal qualifications. Both Kardama Muni and Devahuti were spiritually enlightened. Therefore, she desired from the beginning that first she be pregnant, and then she be empowered with the achievement of God's grace and love of God. For a woman, it is a great ambition to have a son of the same quality as a highly qualified husband. Since she had the opportunity to have Kardama Muni as her husband, she also desired to have a child by bodily union. Om Ajnanta Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Uta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagra Jatan Sahagana Raganatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha He Krishna Kuruna Sindhu Dino Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanjana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Patita Nam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasade Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Beg for the blessings of the assembled devotees, disciples of Srila Prabhupada, ask for your blessings. May our words and our consciousness be aligned with Guru Parampara. May Shri Shri Radha Shyam Sundar be pleased. May all the devotees be benefited by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam together. Hare Krishna. Again, this is Canto 3, Chapter 23, entitled Devahuti's Lamentation, Text 10. Sri Devahuti said, "My dear husband, O best of brahmanas, I know that you have achieved perfection and are the master of all the infallible mystic powers because you are under the protection of Yoga Maya, the transcendental nature. But you once made a promise that our bodily union should now fulfill, since children are a great quality for a chaste woman who has a glorious husband." Previously, Vidura asked Maitreya Rishi to tell him more about Svayambhuvasya Vamsha, Paramasammata. He said that this, "Tell me more about the line of Svayambhuva Manu, because it is very highly glorious." Because who comes in this line of Svayambhuva Manu? So many great personalities and avatars. Prithumaraj, Shaktivesh avatar, comes from this line. Rishabdev. And here, this is all leading, of course, to the appearance of Kapila Dev, another Shaktivesh avatar of the Lord. Kapila's Tattva Sankhyata Bhagavan. Kapila Dev also came. The Lord Himself comes to give transcendental knowledge. No one else can really give transcendental knowledge. It has to come from the Lord, the Shastra, His devotee, His pure devotee. This is how we know the truth of life and existence through our own speculation. We can't come to those conclusions, right? We can get certain realizations from material life. What is the fruit realization? What is the highest realization one can get from material experience, from their own knowledge, their own realization, without any transcendental influence? The key realization we want to get from experiencing everything again and again is to see the futility of all material efforts and attempts to achieve what we really long for in our heart: happiness, love, purity. This is a realization we can get from experience, that it's not here. What do I do? Where do I go? Those questions, that's the fruit of the realization of material life. One starts to seek and look for an answer. I don't know it. I can't seem to find it, but there must be something. So let me stay open to that and search and seek. And then the amazing thing is actually there. The truth is there. And then the next challenge is now you have to surrender to it. So people are seeking. And then something comes. You may come in contact with a person who knows, tattvavit, one who knows the truth. But were you really seeking? Now it will be shown if you were really seeking. Because if you're really seeking, then when you hear it, after using your intelligence and taking some time, but now will you surrender to it? Now will you give your life to it? That's another question. So the Lord comes to give transcendental knowledge. Kapila Dev comes. These chapters coming up are just wonderful. He gives all the different tattvas. You know, we talk a lot of different terms, Sanskrit terms. Even when we look at our subtle body, there's the chitta, the consciousness. There's the manas, the mind, buddhi, the intelligence. Kapila Dev gives the definition of all of these terms, the clear definition, what all of these things exactly mean in upcoming chapters, all the different tattvas. That's important to have as a foundation of our understanding. So it's a great section coming up. So Kapila Dev, this is all leading to the appearance of Kapila Dev. And when the Lord comes into this material world, He likes to honor His own system. So He'll also come through a mother and a father. That's the way we come, right? The human being comes through mother and father. So He comes through a mother and father also, but it looks similar, but it's also different because it's like a play. It's His divine play. He appears also in that way. It's a free play of His to come in that way. He doesn't have to, but He likes to. He honors that. This is how we come. So this is called Leela. His appearance also, He chooses. Imagine, so if He's going to choose to accept a mother and father, who must that mother and father be? How glorious if God Himself is going to come through these two personalities. How wonderful, how pure, how glorious must they be? And that's what we're hearing about here. We're hearing about Devahuti. Verses 1 through 5 are the glories of Devahuti. She is Sadvi. Sadvi. This is the feminine term for sadhu. You know, she is so remarkable, Devahuti. You know, she willingly is accepting so many hardships in the service of her husband. Just think for a moment where she came from. She's the daughter of Svayambhuva Manu, the king. So she grew up with all comforts, all facilities. Anything she wanted, she also had maid servants serving her, anything she needed or wanted. So she grew up that way. So what does that do to a person usually? You know? It's hard for that kind of a person to perform great austerities, or they can feel entitled. But then she accepts a husband. It was arranged that she would accept Kardama Muni as her husband, who is like an ascetic yogi devotee who's living in a remote hermitage somewhere and performing just austerities. He's just an ascetic, you know? And she accepts him, and she lives just like him for a long time, just serving him completely, totally dedicated, totally devoted to him. And it says in text 6 of this chapter that Kardama Muni, he became astonished by her devotion and the consequences that had on her physical body. She became very weak and emaciated serving him. So looking at her, he's becoming astonished. Wow. You know, the way you have served, your devotion, your respect, your love, and also what it has done to you. None of you are indifferent. This is amazing. And because he's so astonished and so grateful for how she is served, then he is eager to give her everything that he has attained. We heard just in previous chapters, what did he attain? He attained the direct darshan of the Lord. He is completely a pure devotee. And he wants to also, he's eager to give this to her because of her devotion. So this is very significant. If we take it out of the context for a moment of husband and wife, really what's going on here, this is the guru-disciple relationship. If one serves the spiritual master with this kind of devotion, becoming indifferent to one's body, just giving, serving consistently, persistently, then the spiritual master will look upon that disciple with time and think, I want to make this disciple my kripa patra, the object of mercy. I want everything that I have, I want them to have it. Imagine you get a wish like that from your spiritual master, that he looks upon you and thinks, whatever I've attained, I want, Krishna, I want that this soul also achieves it and receives it. So it's a nice thing. Jiva Goswami explains, how do you become that for your spiritual master? How do you become the object of mercy of your spiritual master? He gives two points. One, he says, seva sangha. You have to associate by service. Service attitude, you know. This means coming off the platform, the egoistic consciousness, you know. Usually if we're by ourselves and living independently and living in our own way, we remain in the center of our life and our decisions. But to be close to the spiritual master and to really serve, it's a very high thing, actually. It means to come off that platform that I'm the center, and you're just looking, where can I serve? Where's the opportunity to serve my spiritual master? You know, I had the opportunity of serving my spiritual master, and sometimes just some personal service or driving around and some menial things. So just remember, trying to be in that state of consciousness when being near him, looking what's needed, what's just watching it very carefully, like you, vigilant, very attentive, very awake. What does he need right now? Okay, he's talking to these devotees. Maybe some water, they're sitting for a long time, maybe some water should be brought. Whatever it is, just looking very closely, what is the nice way to serve? And also, but one has to also do it expertly. This is a lesson that I had to learn many times. I was had that nice mood, but I would make lots of mistakes and not do things so expertly. But I learned, he trained me in some ways by some correction, you know. He stayed with us in New York for some months a long time ago, I remember, His Holiness Radhanath Swami. I would usually drive him to the airport. So he was leaving after being with us for some time. This time he wanted, someone else volunteered to drive, so he just wanted me to go along to help out, but it was this other person that came to pick him up. So we were going from the ashram there to this devotee's car who was waiting outside. So I took Maharaj's bag, big bag, and very heavy and very big. And so when we went outside to go to the car that was just right, this is New York City, crazy scene, so many people, bikes flying by, cars going everywhere, but this car was right in front of the temple. And so I take the bag and I'm going, just rolling it to the car, open the trunk, I put the bag in the car, and a lot of devotees are gathered to say goodbye. And Maharaj just looks at me, and he said, and this was after, you know, months of just such sweetness, so many nice exchanges, so many things, so close association. And he looks at me and he says, "You are so lazy." In front of, you know, all of the other brahmacharis, everybody that's there, and everybody's just face was like shocked. He became very serious and grave. And I was like, what happened? What did I do? You know, devastated, actually. And other people were kind of like, okay, well, Maharaj, so nice. You know, he's giving hugs and embraces to everybody. And again, I thought maybe he's just, I'll just go to him and offer, you know, my apology. I don't know what I was thinking, actually. I kind of blacked out. So he's looking around at everybody, saying goodbye, smiling, embracing, and then he looks at me again and he just shook his head and said, "So lazy." He gets in the car. I get in the back seat and go to the airport. Yeah, I'm like in another state of consciousness. You know, I can't think, can't speak. So I'm thinking, what did I do wrong here? Just looking at it very carefully. So what I came to understand later, and this, because this is, the guru has a certain sensitivity. He's very thoughtful. And if you look closely and you make these mistakes, you learn how to serve expertly. How vigilant we have to be. So I learned later by seeing the same situation happen with somebody else. And I heard what Maharaj said, which was why he was upset that day. So what happened was, I took this big bag and I was rolling it outside to the car. It was lightly raining that day. So if the wheels are touching the ground and there's dirt and there's some leaves and things like that, then I put that dirty suitcase, the leaves, into somebody's car. And this person was, you know, coming to pick up Maharaj, the trunk was completely clean, just everything was arranged, nothing in there. And I put this car, which the wheels had some dirt and some leaves stuck to it, and I put it into a very clean trunk. So Maharaj saw that and said, "You are so lazy, because why can't you lift this instead of rolling it on the ground?" You know? So I took note of that, of course, next time. And if someone's coming to serve, someone was eager to come and serve Maharaj, clean the whole car, made everything nice, clean the trunk, everything set up, and I wasn't thinking about that devotee. I was thinking about my spiritual master, but not about that devotee. And if a little rain is there, you know, it's raining a little bit, things especially can get wet and dirty, so that little carrying that suitcase to the car, and then I learned that Maharaj is thinking so much about these other devotees. So my service also, when I'm very attentive to him, also be very attentive to the devotees around him and serve them also. So just an example of me being not such a good servant, but learning. This is also what the spiritual master is meant to do. This is why it's good to be around the spiritual master. Why is essential? To try to be close if you have an opportunity, because things like this will affect you for your life. How many disciples of Prabhupada have one encounter or a few words that has stayed with them their whole life and has corrected their life and changed their life and their way of thinking and acting? So Jiva Goswami says, to become the object of mercy of the spiritual master, this is the first thing, seva sangha. And he also says another thing is shravana sangha, that you should be very eager to always hear from the spiritual master. Always eager to hear. Listen carefully. Even if the spiritual master is talking about something that seems to be mundane, it'll eventually come back to Krishna consciousness in some lesson or some teaching. I also learned that from being with my spiritual master. He's talking about something happening in the material world, but then you're catching things. You're catching some perspective. How does a Krishna conscious person think about this? I sometimes used to have questions, but I didn't like to ask them to my spiritual master. It's good to ask questions, of course, but if you're personally with the spiritual master a lot, then maybe not good to have so many questions. You know, I'm taking a 2-hour drive, a 3-hour drive. I can see he wants to be at peace, and for me just to have all these questions at that time may not be appropriate. So I didn't ask many questions, but I had many questions. And then at one point I realized, you know, I was thinking, this is such an opportunity, I could get so many personal instructions, but I was staying quiet. And then I realized at one point that actually I don't even have to ask questions. Everything he's doing and saying with others or how he's acting, it's all upadesh. It's all instruction to me. It's all instructions. If I'm looking very carefully, how he's dealing, how he's talking, what he's doing, how he's careful, how he's attentive, how he chants, I realize everything he's doing is upadesh, instruction to me. So no need to bother him unnecessarily unless there's something, you know, some opportunity, and I see that there's an opportunity from him to ask question. But let me just stay quiet and just serve. And then from that realization, then I started to become very aware and watching everything, looking at everything, and then seeing that everything, he's giving me is teachings and instructions in different forms. So we're talking about this here because Devahuti, the way she served Kardamuni, And Prabhupada, again, he emphasizes in the purport, this is guru-disciple relationship, and one has to receive this kind of blessing from the spiritual master, from service, and also the eagerness to hear. Always, when the opportunity is there, sit down right next to the spiritual master and hear very attentively. Because it's not just the words or the points or the intellectual presentation or the different ideas, it's the actual vibration of the sound. Why? What's different about that vibration? It's described here. It says Kardama Muni is under the yoga maya potency. He's under the spiritual energy. If a person is fully under the spiritual energy, then their movements, their talk, their words, their actions, everything is a vibration of the spiritual energy. So if you are near and you are open, this can be transferred to a person. This is how bhakti comes to a person. It comes through the one who has it, the association, sadhu sangha, to associate with a devotee who's under the pure spiritual energy. In that sangha, bhakti can be transferred to you. Rupa Goswami has a verse, Avirbhuya vano manovritto prajanti tat svarupatam, from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He says that Avir Bhav is the appearance day of Lord Ramchandra. It was the appearance day of Nrsingadev. So in the same way, bhakti appears, descends. Where does it descend to? He says, manovritto. It enters the vrittis in your mind. You have to imagine, this is actually what's happening. Bhakti is a shakti. It's an energy of the Lord. And it appears and descends onto the mind of the conditioned being. And it becomes, because it's spiritual energy now in contact with material energy, because the mind and the chitta vrittis, these are all material movements, but now it's being touched by the bhakti shakti and svarupatam. It transforms the mind. It becomes one with the mind, the bhakti shakti. And so what's the environment in which that takes place is in sadhu sangha. So in the association of a sadhu, if one is hearing, if one is serving, if one is open, then there is actually this transference of the spiritual energy into the heart of another person who's there. It's not going to be by some independent study or independent practice. If we chant, we should know the best chanting is to chant with sadhus, with them, at the same time. If we're doing sankirtan, we should know the best sankirtan is to be in sadhu sangha, that we're actually chanting with sadhus who have love for Krishna in the holy name. So really our main desire and our main prayer to Krishna is, please allow me to be in sadhu sangha again and again, because that's where Krishna's mercy. If you pray to Krishna for love of God, you probably won't get it. Because the way his arrangement is that he's given it to, it's in the heart of the sadhu, and through them, this is his arrangement, through them, you can get it. Krishna, please give me love. Really, it should be Krishna, please give me sadhu sangha, because that's how you give your love. So, therefore, Prabhupada in this purport also, he's quoting a verse, another verse from the Bhagavad Gita. This is in Bhagavad Gita as well. Which verse is this? 9:13, I believe. Here's Gita. I'll just read this verse because same point from Krishna. Who is the Mahatma? So Krishna says who the Mahatma is. Mahatmanas tumam parta daivam prakritim ashrita. Daiva means divine. Prakritim means nature or energy. Ashrita. Again, they are under the daivi prakriti. They are under the divine nature or energy. That is who a great soul is. That is the Vaishnav. They are under the divine energy of the Lord. And what's the symptom of that? Bhajanti ananya manaso. They are engaged. And Prabhupada says here, Bhajanti means to render service, ananya, manaso, without any deviation in the mind. If we're in material consciousness, you can't do that. You can't have undeviating service in the mind to Guru and Krishna. But if you surrender to the sadhu, to the spiritual master, and come under the energy, the spiritual energy, now you can have undeviating mind in the service of the Lord. So a lot of times we're stuck in material consciousness. We have this purusha abhiman, that I'm the center, I'm the enjoyer. And then we're trying to serve and we think I have to try harder. But if you have purusha abhiman, trying harder doesn't do it. You're trying harder, but the root is that I am the enjoyer. I am the center. If you're trying to do more service, but you have purusha abhiman, that I'm the center, but you're trying to do more service, that also doesn't work. So we want to do service as much as we can. We want to try harder, but we should know simultaneously, but unless I fully surrender my heart to Guru and Krishna, and the spiritual energy comes and takes over my consciousness, takes over my mind, then I can't actually have an undeviating service attitude, and I can't be engaged as I want to be engaged, fully, completely. So therefore, the real emphasis, of course, trying and doing everything we can, but also with this clear understanding of a full surrender is what makes the shift, is what opens the consciousness to receive the spiritual energy. Prabhupada says in the purport also here, the Lord has two energies, and then he mentions the third, of course, that primarily the Lord has three energies, Tatashta Shakti, that is us. This is an energy of God. He has his internal spiritual energy, and he has the material energy, and then there's us. We stand between the two, and we choose, which energy will I come under? Narada Muni in Bhagavatam, he says, since time immemorial, the conditioned soul, what is that term? Vishajeta. He's totally guneshu. He's totally surrendered himself and has given up himself to the modes of material nature. This is the conditioned soul. It's also a state of surrender. I surrender to the material energy. And then as soon as you surrender, this material energy gets inside of you. All the different modes of nature, the different impressions, the material experiences, everything comes inside, and we get so overloaded with the material energy that it looks like we're very free every moment, that I'm going to do this, I want to do that, I like this, I like that. But really, it's the modes of nature inside of me. They're very deep, and they're coming to the surface of my consciousness, and then I make a decision or I have a thought. We think our thoughts, we're so... You know, to think that we're in a state of freedom is a great illusion. Of course, we have freedom. But it's very, very covered. You know, think about your life. It looks like, you know, you're trying to figure out what to do in this circumstance in your life. And you're thinking about it for a long time. You can't quite find out what you should do. And then one day, you make a decision, I'm going to do this. You feel very free, right? You feel like, well, I made that decision because I have free will. But actually, the way it works is that unlimited impressions are deep in the chitta. And then they come to the surface of your mind in different phases. There are different steps. And the last step is that it comes to your mind and you think something or you make a decision. That's the last stage. We think it's the first stage because we think we have freedom. But it's the last stage in a process where, you know, there's a verse in the Padma Purana that says that these impressions, there's a stage called kutam, where it's like, it's not even formed yet as a desire. It's like a subtle manifestation from a previous impression. It's just sitting in there. That we're filled with them. That's all that's inside of the conditioned soul, actually. I mean, you know, we're not talking about the Atma. The Atma is identified with this whole system. Because of that identification, everything that happens in that system, we say that that is me. So anyway, because of the identification, kutam eventually comes to another stage called bij, Now it forms as a desire. So from an unmanifest state, even though it's something there in your subtle body, then it becomes like a formed desire. And then it comes into your conscious awareness and you think, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to marry this person, not that person. That's all my freedom, right? No. It's not. It's the everything coming slowly through different phases to the surface, then something comes to our mind and then we act on it. Now, when you become a devotee, of course, something now happens, something very special happens. Some new opportunities arise. I'm talking about the very covered, conditioned soul, the ordinary person in this material world. But we should know, even just because we call ourselves a devotee doesn't mean I've suddenly become free from this whole system. So everything is coming up, a thought comes up suddenly, and I think, I had that thought. I decided to have that thought even. But no, this is the last step of something that's been happening subtly inside of your subtle body. And finally, the last stage is a thought, an action comes. So what we think is the first thing, an action, a thought, is actually the last thing. And then by acting, then that also sets in motion a karmic reaction that gets put back into my subtle body. And now more, filling it up again. So the reason why it's so important to know this and to realize that I have very little power to make choices is because we can feel entrapped, which we are entrapped. We can see to what extent we are entrapped and then pray and beg for mercy and then chant the holy name with attention, knowing it's the only hope. But if we think I'm just in control, and I'm free, and I'm making decisions, you know, in real time, then that attitude will actually prevent one from taking deep shelter. You don't realize just how entrapped you are. If we think about this very deeply, our chanting and our attention will increase because we think, oh my goodness, I have... and also our gratitude. Some other thing has been shown to me. Some graces, there's a way out of this. What is the way out? We quoted that verse from Rupa Goswami. Something else besides a material influence and a material energy has to come into me. Something else. That is bhakti. Bhakti is the internal energy of the Lord. We say the Lord has his internal energy, but that internal energy also has divisions. It's not just one thing. It has primarily three divisions, Sandini, Samvit, and Hladini Shakti. These are all three vrittis of the internal energy. So you could take the internal energy as the Lord's spiritual energy, Svarup Shakti. And then this spiritual energy also has different functions and vrittis. Hladini, it gives great joy, the joy of service, the joy of relationship with Krishna. Samvit Shakti. It gives the realization of Krishna and the realization of who you truly are. It reveals that to you. So bhakti is said to be a combination of the Samvit and the Hladini Shaktis. So if you have this bhakti enter you, that means it reveals God to you. The Samvit Shakti, the cognizance potency. Cognizant of what? You become conscious of God. You actually begin to truly know God. He is revealed. And you begin to know who you are, the Atma, and the service. So this is all revealed by the Samvit Shakti. And then Hladini Shakti, because now you're in contact with God, this relationship is ecstatic. There's joy in service. Such joy, unlimited joy, just increases and increases and increases. So bhakti is a combination of these two shaktis. And of course, the Sandini Shakti is also in it. Because there's a statement I came across from Jiva Goswami where he says that just like the three modes of nature, if you have goodness, but it's never pure goodness, it's always also touched by rajas and tamas. So these three energies too, the Samvit, Shakti, Hladini, they're never completely alone. They're also touched by the other shaktis. So if you have, you know, the haladini shakti, it also includes some vit shakti, a little bit. It's just not predominating. You know, so when we say haladini shakti, it means haladini shakti is predominating over the other shaktis, samvit and sandini. And if you have sandini, you also have contained within that some little bit of haladini. Anyway. But the point is, this is the spiritual energy that we somehow have to come under. And it's done by this relationship to the spiritual master. It comes in that way. I was asked also to speak a little something. Let me just check. I wanted to share a little something of Jayananda Prabhu. I was asked to do so. And it's very befitting because we're talking about Devahuti. In some ways, she conquered the heart of Kardama Muni, and he wanted to give to him, to her, everything that he had attained. So just imagine this scene right now. Tamal Krishna Goswami describes this, that Prabhupada, a few days after Jayananda Prabhu had left his body, Prabhupada was in his room. Tamal Krishna Goswami was there. And Tamal Krishna Goswami noticed that Prabhupada was crying. So he went up to Srila Prabhupada and asked him, Prabhupada, what are you thinking of right now? And Prabhupada said, I am so fortunate to have had a disciple like Jayananda Prabhu. Imagine Prabhupada thinking, meditating on Jayananda Prabhu, crying in gratitude. This Jayananda Prabhu became the Kripa Patra of Srila Prabhupada. He became the object of Prabhupada's deepest desire for his welfare, for him to become Krishna conscious. Jayananda Prabhu was a very special soul. Of course, there's so much to say, we don't have much time, but we just, it's unprecedented what Prabhupada arranged for. After his passing, you know, that this letter goes out to the whole society. Actually, the first thing he said, Prabhupada, when he heard of Jayananda Prabhu's passing, is that if he had any material desires, then he has gone to the heavens, because the heavens are, they're devotees of the Lord, but there's still some material desires. But then he also finished that letter by saying, but because he was always in such nice consciousness and doing service, that he has gone to Vaikuntha. And then later, Prabhupada learned from Rameshwar Prabhu of the details of Jayananda Prabhu's passing. The details was, he was there, Rameshwar Prabhu, and Jayananda Prabhu was a little bit curled up. And he said he just started to, with great effort, straighten out his arms. This is when he's actually actively dying. And he straightened out both his legs, and it took a great effort. And then he lifted his head, and on the near him, they put a speaker of Prabhupada chanting. And he just put his head and his ear on that speaker. And he gave up his body. So when Rameshwar Prabhu told Prabhupada of the details of how he passed, then Prabhupada again had another response to the whole situation. He said, yes, the passing, it's in a letter, the passing of Jayananda Prabhu was completely glorious and Krishna consciousness. He has definitely gone back to Vaikuntha. Just imagine, this gives us such hope, doesn't it? Because he's an ordinary conditioned soul from America, happened to be, you know. Actually, he says, he had commented that he was a very unhappy person. He was unhappy because he was a very good soul, actually, and the suffering that he saw in life. Even though he was very competent, he was handsome, intelligent. He was very unlike the devotees at that time in the sense that he was a little older and he had already had a college degree. He studied mechanical engineering. He had money saved in the bank. He had a couple jobs. So he was like a very competent, a little older than devotees. He was never a hippie, actually. He was just a good soul, but he also mentioned that he felt unhappiness because of the suffering of life. And so as soon as he met Prabhupada, it's amazing, he just completely surrendered. Like almost on the spot. He saw some note that there would be a Swami coming to San Francisco. He went to it. He listened. That's it. My life is dedicated to this person. And it never wavered. So this has to be some previous connection. That's all I can think of. I don't see how someone in a moment can give themselves in that way. But he did. And Prabhupada was always so grateful for Jayananda Prabhu. He would always recall that Jayananda Prabhu gave, he was the first to give $5,000. This is 1967, I believe. I looked it up. $5,000 in 1967, today, is about $52,000 in you know, purchasing worth, value. So immediately met Prabhupada. Had money, like he had, and he kept working jobs. He was a taxi driver. He was doing things on the side. He was finding all kinds of ways to make money. He would engage so many people in service. He would just go outside and work on something, work on one of the cars at the temple, and people would walk by and say, "Hey, you give me a hand with this part," and they'd start serving and helping him out. Then he'd bring them prasadam, and then they all ended up loving him. Everybody loved Jayananda Prabhu. Prabhupada, I mean, even the spiritual master, but just ordinary people who got to know. He knew everybody on a first-name basis in the neighborhood near the temple. So people would come to collect the garbage. They all knew Jayananda. "Where's Jayananda?" He would talk to them, bring them prasadam. So friendly, so kind to everybody. This conscious, we should study his consciousness and his service attitude very deeply, because look what it did to Srila Prabhupada. He was in tears thinking of his disciple saying, "I am so fortunate and grateful to have had a disciple like Jayananda Prabhu." It's inconceivable. So, but I want to read also one thing I was asked to read. I'm sorry, this may go a couple minutes over. But I was asked to read the offering, an offering to Jayananda Prabhu from Ridayananda Maharaj. He wanted to share an offering. This was Prabhupada's actually request of us in this movement, that every year, another thing that's amazing, right? Every year, celebrate the disappearance of Jayananda Prabhu, just like we do with our other acharyas. Put it on the calendar. Put his picture on the Rathiyatra cart, wherever Rathiyatra is happening from here on out. This is amazing. So this was Prabhupada's request, and so Ridayananda Maharaj also has a nice offering here. I was requested to read it. So this is from Ridayananda Maharaj. "I first met my godbrother Jayananda under very interesting circumstances. It was around November or December of 1972, and I was living in the Berkeley Temple. There was also a temple in San Francisco, of course, the historic Haight-Ashbury Temple on Frederick Street. But since Berkeley is on the other side of the bay, about 40 minutes away, I had never really met those devotees. One evening, we were having a program at the Berkeley Temple, a beautiful house near the campus. The temple room was on the third floor, originally a converted attic, and the whole house suddenly began to shake. Being in California, my first thought was earthquake. I had been in the Hare Krishna movement less than 2.5 months at that point. The temple president told me to go downstairs and find out what was happening, since the shaking seemed to be coming from below. It was not an earthquake. It was the San Francisco devotees, the brahmacharis, who had come across the bay to make a proposal to us. They were gathered in the large prasadam room, which was a beautiful house with carved hardwood shelves, and they were in the big prasadam room doing kirtan. It was extraordinarily powerful, like Sergeant Rock and the Marines. By the time I had joined the movement, the San Francisco temple had transformed from its early Haight-Ashbury days with its mix of men, women, and hippies into a really intense brahmachari group. They were great, devoted, and powerful. They had come to have an ishtagoshti with us and propose a joint program for Gaur Purnima, which in those days would have been practically the first big festival ever held for Gaur Purnima. They suggested holding it in Berkeley on Telegraph Avenue. So we all sat down together, and this really shows you what the movement was like then. The leaders discussed it, and all the devotees were present. Though I had only been there 2 months, I was included as well. I happened to sit down next to Jayananda, and I was in an ecstatic mood, as I often was in those days. We began talking, and he just looked like a saint. At some point, I said something to him like, "You're a really great devotee." I was just a young kid. He immediately deflected and said, "No, no, no, not me. Madhavisa, he is a great devotee. He's the temple president." He spoke about Madhavisa with such genuine admiration. In fact, Srila Prabhupada called him the emperor of Sankirtan. What struck me deeply in that moment was his genuine humility. Of course, we all talked about humility in the temple. We knew that was the goal. And there were customary expressions of respect. "Jai Prabhu, with all due respect." But Jayananda was not simply talking the talk. He was so deeply, sincerely humble that I never forgot it. That was December 1969. I had just sat down next to a devotee I had never met before, and the impression stayed with me for the rest of my life. I have never really met anyone who was that deeply and sincerely humble. Soon after, we in Berkeley began going to San Francisco almost every day to do Sankirtan and collect, since Berkeley was a small college town, where you quickly encountered the same people again. I remember one occasion on Telegraph Avenue when I approached a university dean who clearly passed up and down that street every day during his lunch break and had been approached by devotees countless times. He was visibly agitated when I came up to him with a magazine. When he came back from lunch and I approached him again, because the rule was that you had to approach everyone, he was beside himself. But those were the standards. So we began spending more time in San Francisco. A real sense of camaraderie developed between the Berkeley and San Francisco devotees. There was a sense of genuine solidarity, of being one spiritual family. Eventually, the leaders proposed something quite revolutionary for the time. Rather than keeping the entire Sankirtan party together on one street, we might spread out and go to other streets a block or two away. This felt almost daring. Could we really do that? Be a couple of blocks away from the main party? I was sent out with Jayananda. Just the two of us, with a small pair of cartels. We would stop somewhere in downtown San Francisco and do a little kirtan, and he would speak since he was the senior devotee. He was always wonderfully natural and kind, like a warm uncle. I remember one moment when a small crowd had gathered and he addressed them in his characteristic way. He was from Kansas, and he had a folksy manner, very folksy manner. He said, "Folks, try this at home. Don't worry if you haven't got Indian instruments. Just get some pots and pans from your kitchen, grab a big spoon, and you can do your own kirtan right there." It was ingenious in its simplicity. Another memory I carry is from later that winter in January, when San Francisco turns very cold. Mark Twain once said that the coldest winter he ever spent was a summer in San Francisco, and that rings true. The ocean water is freezing, and when the wind comes in off the northeast end of the peninsula, it cuts right through you. We were not exactly well equipped for the weather. Our cold weather gear consisted of a dhoti, a kurta, and a cotton sweatshirt with a hood. And the wind chill was probably near freezing. Hardly anyone stopped. But those were very happy times. Jayananda was probably at least 10 years older than me, and standing out there in the cold of North Beach, we would just talk like brothers, talking about Krishna, occasionally selling a magazine or two. There were just two of us out in the cold, and it was genuinely joyful. He was a real older brother to me, and he had no false ego whatsoever. He was a very sincere soul who always seemed to think other people were better than himself, and not out of any psychological insecurity or low self-esteem, but out of something genuinely spiritual. His humility was real. Around April of 1970, Prabhupada sent for me. He heard that I was quoting Sanskrit in the classes. I had been learning the Ishopanishad verses, and he wanted to speak with me. When I went to him, he decided that I should go to Boston to work on the production of his books. as ISKCON Press was there. I returned to Berkeley to prepare, and after that, I did not really see Jayananda again. By the time we crossed paths later, I was a sannyasi. I knew he spent time in New York for a while, and of course, he became famous for his Rath Yatra festivals. After that period, I largely lost contact with him. We were always working within the same mission, but our paths did not cross very often. Yet in my early formative years, he left a very strong mark on me, his purity, his humility, and his warm, folksy personality. That is what I remember of Jayananda from Kansas. Jayananda Prabhu ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Gaura Premanandi. It's okay, Pran Govind Prabhu, to stop, or should I allow devotees to share anything? Okay, I just thought we went a little over, so. But if anybody wanted to share something, Jayananda Prabhu, something you experienced or something on your heart? Okay. Hare Krishna.